ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
G'day, welcome to PM. I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Tonight, completely unacceptable. The Prime Minister demands answers from Israel after an Australian aid worker is killed in Gaza. Also, more signals from the Reserve Bank. Interest rates may have to stay high for longer. And with musicians still struggling after the pandemic, is it time for new rules to make sure they're paid properly for performing?
It's a really hard space to make money out of it. When I talk to my accountant and he just thinks that I'm stark raving bonkers.
Thanks for your company. The Prime Minister is demanding full accountability after an Australian aid worker was killed in an apparent Israeli airstrike in Gaza. Zomi Francom was born in Melbourne. She'd been working for the World Central Kitchen, which in a statement said she was one of seven aid workers killed while travelling in cars branded with the charity's logo. The aid group says the workers from the US, the UK, Poland, Australia and the Palestinian territories were hit while leaving a warehouse after unloading food aid brought to Gaza by sea. And as a result of the strike, WCK has paused all operations in the region at a time of looming famine. The deaths have sparked widespread condemnation. The Prime Minister said it was completely unacceptable, and Israel's ambassador in Australia has been called in to explain. Rima Chia reports.
Hey, this is Zomi and Chef Olivier. We're at the Jerabalaf kitchen.
Zomi Francom was in the central Gazan town of Deir al-Balah a week ago, recording this video as her team at the World Central Kitchen prepared desperately needed meals.
This is the beautiful, fragrant, aromatic rice that will be served today from Deir al-Balah kitchen.
It's one of more than 60 community kitchens the group has in Gaza, preparing hundreds of thousands of meals. Zomi Francom had been based in Bangkok, leading the World Central Kitchen, or WCK's, Asia operations for the last 5 years. Her friend Dora Weekly says the first time she met Zomi, they were working in the Bahamas for WCK.
Zomi was relentless. She was huge-hearted and just really, I'm going to cry. Just really dedicated and really driven. Worked all hours and just would put everything into it, you know.
Their work for WCK brought them together again on the New South Wales south coast during the Black Summer fires. Dora Weekly says her friend's commitment to others took her all over the world, and her incredible energy was an inspiration.
So she was feeding people that had been displaced, people that were homeless, people that had nowhere to go. She was often kind of doing community outreach and finding where the people in need were and making sure that they would have a hot meal every day.
World Central Kitchen is a non-profit NGO that provides meals worldwide in response to crises. Ms. Francom was in central Gaza to help distribute hundreds of tons of food from a second maritime shipment that arrived from Cyprus. The charity says when she was killed, she was travelling in what's described as a deconflicted zone in a convoy of two armoured vehicles branded with the WCK logo. They were delivering food to famine-stricken parts of the north. Palestinian journalist Hind Al-Khudari spoke to her before they left.
And I started asking them, what's going on? When are you moving? When will the aid ship arrive to the port? And they said that they were waiting to the green light from the Israeli authorities to cross to the northern area. And I saw all of their faces and I recognized them. It's horrifying. First of all, because I met them and I talked to them. And the second thing was because it was like a couple of hours between the time where I met them and the time where I actually saw them killed, covered with blood.
On their way back from northern Gaza, Hind heard a huge explosion nearby the Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah.
Ambulances that carried their bodies arrived and no one noticed what was going on because they were obviously wearing armored vests and they had this logo. So it took us time to find their IDs. Do you know, like, my wish is that I didn't talk to the aid workers today because I never imagined that I'm gonna cover their killing a couple of hours later after talking to them.
The convoy was hit by an apparent Israeli airstrike. WCK says 7 people were killed, including 6 were foreign nationals from Australia, Poland, the UK and a dual citizen of the US and Canada, and 1 Palestinian. In a statement, Zomi's family says she was a kind, selfless and outstanding human being and was killed doing the work she loves. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese offered his condolences to Zomi's family and friends. He also called in the Israeli ambassador to Australia for some answers.
We certainly have already contacted the Israeli government directly. We are contacting the Israeli ambassador to ask for accountability here. The truth is that this is beyond any reasonable circumstances. Someone going about providing aid and humanitarian assistance should lose their life.
The Israeli military says it's conducting a thorough review at the highest levels to understand the circumstances of this tragic incident, and that the Israeli Defence Force had been working closely with WCK to coordinate the delivery of food and humanitarian aid in Gaza. But the tragedy has had a major impact. The World Central Kitchen has announced that it's pausing its operations in the region immediately. Aid agencies around the world are stunned by the incident. Mark Purcell is the chief executive of the Australian Council for International Development. Mark says the Australian government demanding answers from Israel is in line with their international obligations.
It's right that the PM calls for accountability in Zomi's death and that of her colleagues, but what we're seeing in Gaza is the use of food or the denial of food aid as what appears to be a deliberate tactic in the war by the Israeli Defence Force. This is against the Geneva Conventions. Australia is a government that upholds the rule of law internationally.
Lucia Goldsmith is the head of humanitarian at Oxfam Australia, who have aid workers living in Gaza. She says the risks they face in trying to distribute aid in areas that are completely destroyed are made worse by being in an active war zone.
NGOs already have very comprehensive safety protocols in place. But together with UN agencies, we have been repeatedly raising that Israel is failing to respect the notification system that exists to share movements and coordinates with the Israeli military to protect aid workers from targeting.
It's unclear when World Central Kitchen will resume its operations.
That report from Rima Chia and Alexandra Humphreys. Millions of households in Australia face the prospect of paying higher interest rates for longer. Minutes from the Reserve Bank's March meeting were released today. They highlight the bank's concerns that inflation remains too high. Part of the story is stronger than expected employment. New data underlines there's still no shortage of work in the economy. And those who own property and shares continue to benefit from record-breaking runs. All of it is adding heat to an economy the RBA is desperate to cool down. Here's business reporter David Taylor.
If you've recently paid your energy bill, filled up the car or paid insurance, you'll know inflation's a problem. Westpac's chief economist and former RBA official, Lucy Ellis, says the Reserve Bank knows it all too well.
Well, I think the governor is looking for more assurance that inflation is indeed coming down on the track they expected.
Right now, though, prices in the services economy, so things like rents, healthcare and banking and finance, continue to hurt the hip pocket. Wages are rising to help workers meet these higher costs of living. But, annoyingly, Lucy Ellis says that also means inflation is slow to come down. Put another way, the war against inflation is yet to be won.
I think they can see that victory is around the corner, but they're not ready clear victory just yet. There is still a way to go.
Much hinges on the unemployment rate. A spike in unemployment would, economists say, lead to lower inflation. But don't expect mass job losses anytime soon, says ANZ senior economist Catherine Birch.
So demand for workers is still higher than the actual supply of workers. There are still a lot of employers out there who are still struggling to find workers. But if we look at ANZ Indeed Australian job ads, they're still up 32.1% compared with pre-pandemic, even though they're down almost 11% over the past year.
I think where people get confused is that the economy is quite sluggish and demand has slowed considerably in the economy. Where are companies and firms getting the money to invest and to need to hire workers?
From the business perspective, businesses have been feeling, I think, you know, quite a bit better about the economy than households have, because households are thinking about their own circumstances. Businesses are thinking about overall demand, which has been slowing, but has been buffered by things like the very strong population growth.
There are other positive economic signs too. The share market today, for example, again flirted with fresh record highs. And property data firm CoreLogic notes the average national home value rose 0.6% in March, pushing the overall property market to another record high. Eliza Owen is head of research.
And you could also see it in the capital cities, where more expensive capital cities like Sydney and Melbourne haven't moved much at all. But on the other end of the spectrum, Perth was up 1.9% in the month alone, and it's up nearly 20% over the past year.
Fundamentally, Catherine Birch says, enough people in the economy have money or wealth and a job to keep the economy motoring along and inflation elevated.
You know, a lot of households are doing it really tough. Really, really hard. But the vast majority of households, yes, they're feeling the pressure, but they're able to muddle through. They're still able to keep making their mortgage repayments, keep paying their rent, keep covering their essential expenses. And one of the key reasons for that is because the labour market has been so strong. As long as most people who have a job, who want a job, have a job or can find one pretty quickly, it's really hard to see things falling off a cliff, because if you can hold on to your job and your income, and we know wage growth is picking up now as well, you're much more likely to be able to continue covering all those essential expenses. And that means that demand is not contracting. We're still seeing this economic growth.
The wild card is productivity. The Reserve Bank says workers' higher pay packets need to come with higher levels of productivity, or producing more and generating the earnings that come with that to pay for those higher wages. Without that, economists say, bosses pass on those higher wages to customers in the form of higher prices, further fueling inflation and putting upwards pressure on interest rates. Catherine Birch is also worried about the extra economic stimulus on its way to millions of households.
We've got the tax cuts coming through from the 1st of July, so we think that's equivalent to 225 basis point rate cuts in the 24-25 financial year. And households are also expecting that we've peaked out with rates and the next move will be down. So it will be interesting to see how households respond to those improvements through this year.
Westpac's Lucy Ellis is confident productivity will improve and inflation will come down, putting the Reserve Bank in a position to cut interest rates by September.
Business reporter David Taylor there. This is PM with me, David Lipson. Coming up, concerns koala habitat could fall victim to the Brisbane Olympics. Disability advocates have cautiously welcomed a draft for the National Autism Strategy, saying it is a good first step, but there is room for improvement. The strategy focuses on four key areas and aims to improve the lives of autistic Australians, especially at a time of increased awareness and diagnosis. While the plan was formed after extensive consultation, it's now up to the public to have their say. Isabel Masali reports.
For autistic Australians, there can be many barriers to gaining and retaining employment. Jane Forward points out a pretty big one.
Posting an ad on Seek, getting people to send in a resume, they might be barriers that exclude people with autism from even attempting to apply for a job. The processes just don't bring out the best or connect or allow a potential employer to see the absolutely fantastic offering that the person with autism could bring to an organisation or a workplace.
Jane Forward is the CEO of Perth-based organisation Valued Lives, which provides support for people with autism and other disabilities. That includes setting up businesses and gaining employment.
So I think when we're talking about economic participation, I'd say we're asking the wrong questions. We keep always saying, what do we need to do to fix or make different the person with autism or disability, rather than saying this person has unique value and offering to us as an employer or society, and how can we harvest that? So the question just needs to be flipped on its head.
Economic inclusion is one of four key areas identified in the draft National Autism Strategy, along with social inclusion, diagnosis, services and support, and physical and mental health. And it marks the first strategy of its kind in Australia, aimed at improving the lives of autistic people. Andrew Whitehouse is a professor of autism at the Telethon Kids Institute and the University of Western Australia. Like many, he believes it's a strategy that's well overdue.
I think the National Autism Strategy is, it's important and it's timely, and it makes all the points that really need to be made around the areas in our society in which autistic Australians are often excluded or at least have suboptimal engagement. Things such as health, engaging with the health system, engaging with our schooling system and broader education, as well as employment. And of course, quality of life is really the outcome of all of these factors. So what the National Autism Strategy does is it provides a focus on these areas and how we can provide better inclusion to contribute to greater quality of life for autistic Australians.
But Andrew Whitehouse has this message of caution.
Strategies are really important to set the direction for the broad systems of government, but strategies are only as good as its action and implementation plan. And so really, in that regard, the proof is in the pudding. If we don't make a good action and implementation plan and then act upon it, these will just remain words on a page. And that would be a shame for all Australians.
He'd also like to see the final plan have a greater focus on evidence-based strategies.
An area in which the strategy perhaps could have provided even more clarity on is the requirement for evidence-based supports. We have an area of autism that is littered with a variety of non-evidenced or poor evidence-based therapies and supports. What we need to do in the area of autism is expect and only accept the same levels of evidence for therapies and health and medical practices that we do in other areas. And so we need greater focus on that.
Catherine Anir is autistic, is an autism advocate and an academic working in disability and community inclusion. They appreciate the mammoth task in bringing together the views of stakeholders, autistic people, their families and the government to deliver this draft strategy, but has identified some gaps they hope will be addressed.
It's a good start, but I think when it comes to that complex edge of the wedge where we do have those intersecting levels of oppression and disadvantage, where people are still institutionalised, or where autism or disability is completely conceptually different, like First Nations communities and migrant cultures, I think we've got a long way to go to reach right down vertically into very disadvantaged communities, and also to go out horizontally to the mainstream community and really change those attitudes.
When asked why it's important to get the strategy right, Catherine Anir points to the life expectancy of autistic people being 20 years less than the general population.
So the bottom line is that people's lives are at stake. And when people's lives are at stake, we have to do something. But we're also missing out on the potential of those lives squandered to poor health or homelessness or unjust incarceration. Because every human being brings value to the community. And if we can't recognise that as a society, then we're probably going in the wrong direction.
The strategy is open for public consultation until the end of May, with a final strategy expected to be released later this year.
Isabel Massali. The Queensland government is facing a fresh backlash over its choice of Olympic venues, with concerns a koala habitat will be impacted by development for the 2032 Games. The state government is insisting a $1.6 billion stadium upgrade in Brisbane South won't harm the local koala population. But scientists and conservationists are warning the government has a bad track record when it comes to caring for the state's animal emblem. Stephanie Smale reports.
As athletes pound the track during training at the Queensland Sport and Athletics Centre, koalas are sitting in trees metres away.
And this is a bank of scrilly gums and tallow woods and all sorts of trees. And if you look right there, there is a koala inside the Queensland Academy of Sport.
That's local conservationist Brad Lambert. He's been part of a big pushback against the state government's plans to overhaul the athletics centre in Brisbane South because of the potential harm to the bush nearby.
Another koala. There he is right there, having a nap. And there is the stadium.
Since the initial announcement that this venue would be used for the Olympics, Brad Lambert has welcomed the state government's assurances that bush won't need to be cleared when the stadium is upgraded. But he's worried koalas could still be at risk.
If they want to bulldoze land for the Olympics, I'll do it. That any sort of trimming again to that little bit of bushland will actually have a negative impact on our biodiversity, especially considering we are the most biodiverse capital in Australia and we're the koala capital of Australia, but we keep doing things that are not going to protect that or enhance that in any way.
After months of angry backlash over the planned Olympic venues, the new Premier Stephen Miles commissioned an inquiry into alternative options. It was carried out by former Brisbane Lord Mayor Graham Quirk, who argued against updating the athletics centre, saying national forest adjacent to the stadium would need to be bulldozed. Stephen Griffith is Labor's Brisbane City Councillor for the Moorooka Ward, and even though the state government says the bush won't be disturbed, he's still worried too.
We've got to a stage now where we need to be saying enough is enough. It is about the flora and fauna of the site, and of course it is about the koala population that is healthy and happy and breeding there.
He's calling on the state government to involve community and conservation groups to reduce environmental harm.
I think we've got to really see the figures, see the details and make a decision from there.
Are they being offered to you? What has the state government said about the transparency that will be involved?
They've told me they're working on that information. And frankly, I think the public are entitled to that information so that it's transparent and so that people can understand the pros and cons of each site.
In 2020, this brave new world for koala protection came in, and a lot of elements of it are smoke and mirrors.
Leading koala ecologist Frank Carrick has been watching Queensland's koala population decline for decades. He says any damage to Tui Forest that flanks the athletics centre would be a major setback.
It's particularly ironic with Tui Forest because, probably due to it being circled with main roads, koalas disappeared from Tui Forest for a couple of decades. And they've only, in the last 5 years or so, found their way back into the area. And they're doing pretty well there at the moment.
Frank Carrick, who's an honorary professor and chief investigator at the University of Queensland's Koala Study Program, says it's not only the stadium development that's a potential problem. Transport links are a major threat as well. But he's also realistic, and he argues as development happens, more koala trees must be planted in areas that will actually help them survive.
There should be no net loss of any further koala habitat in southeast Queensland. Now, that doesn't mean that some bits of koala habitat will unfortunately have to be bowled over. You know, I'm not for a minute suggesting that people shouldn't have houses, but it has to be trees in the ground, not, oh, we'll pay you some money or we'll change the tenure of the land. Unfortunately, koalas don't really understand the concept of land tenure. All they understand is they no longer have the trees they used to have.
That's leading koala ecologist Frank Carrick ending Stephanie Smale's report. The Queensland government has provided a statement to PM saying upgrades to the stadium will be on its existing footprint and it won't have an impact on koalas or on Tui Forest. Well, it's not just the cancellation of big music festivals like Splendour in the Grass and Grooving the Moo that have blown a hole in the industry. A new survey suggests overall conditions for musicians continue to get worse, despite hopes of a post-COVID bounce back. It found half the country's musicians earned less than $6,000 a year last year, forcing many to pack up their instruments for good. Industry voices say more support and regulation is needed, as Alison Chow reports.
I held you, my dear.
Folk musician Kimberly Wheeler has been performing for nearly 30 years, and along the way she's had many roles.
I do a number of different things in the music industry. I'm a singer-songwriter. I also play upright bass for myself and for others. I have a studio and I often help people record things or produce their materials.
She says her income from live performing is very unreliable.
25% on average of gigs are unpaid, whether they're for whatever reason, they might be a community fundraiser, or other times you might earn $250 or $300 for a particular show, but they tend to be very few and far between.
To make ends meet, she's had to rely on working other jobs, helping to produce and record music for other artists and offering IT services to clients.
When I talk to my accountant, he looks at that side of my business, and then he looks at the other side of my business, and he just thinks that I'm stark raving bonkers for pursuing music.
Kimberly Wheeler is also a board member at the Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance. The union today released a survey finding half of Australian musicians earned less than $6,000 last year in that industry. That's less than 15% of the national minimum wage. Kimberly Wheeler says local venues have a big part to play, but many of them are also struggling.
There are venues post-pandemic who have really taken up the gauntlet, and they're trying to find ways to do that. They're working equally on the promotion and acknowledge that to have a vibrant industry, we need to support the people who create the content.
The survey of 550 musicians found fewer are able to make a full-time living from their music now compared to 4 years ago, before the pandemic struck. Paul Davies is the campaigns director at the MEAA.
We've got a problem that musicians have not been able to sustain careers in a market that is increasingly making them bear all the risk.
He says one of the most effective strategies would be taking the minimum fee of $250 that's been adopted for publicly funded gigs in most states and territories and applying it across the whole industry.
State governments around the country have recognised the minimum. So whenever there's a gig that has public money in it, that minimum fee has to apply. That's been successful. We want to see that rolled out to the industry at large.
Australian musicians are also losing out in the wake of major festival cancellations. Splendour in the Grass is taking this year off, following in the footsteps of regional festival favourite Groovin' the Moo. But RMIT Associate Professor Catherine Strong says festivals are dealing with a different set of circumstances to those affecting grassroots musicians.
Festivals seem at the moment to be a specific case where all of the things that go into putting on a festival are a bit fragile at the moment, whether it is sort of the locations that they're being held or the fact that, you know, if people are coming from overseas or if you've got vendors coming in, all of those things are more expensive than normal.
But not all big ticket events in the industry are struggling right now. Catherine Strong says medium to large size tours aren't as much at risk at the moment, and part of the solution may lie in redistributing profit that comes from big, successful stadium shows into other segments of the music industry.
The majority of the money from music goes to a very small number of people, and finding a way in which we can sort of like start to redistribute some of that revenue, that's a really, really hard conversation. How we go about doing that is very, very tricky, but it is something that we do need to be looking at to make creativity in Australia a sustainable thing. One of the things that we need to be having more of a discussion about is how much people are willing to pay for tickets when it comes to sort of smaller gigs. People still often balk if they have to pay more than sort of $15 or $20 to go to a gig at their local small venue. So having a broader conversation with the general public about what a musician is worth and what it is worth to go and see live music is one of the things that could be happening.
The federal government is also looking into the issues facing the music industry, which Catherine Strong says is a welcome sign.
The music industry has been incredibly unregulated, and while that has led to amazing creativity in a number of different ways, it has also meant that exploitation has been rife across the music industry.
Last week, a Senate inquiry was launched into the challenges and opportunities facing the Australian live music industry. Submissions to the committee close at the end of this month.
Alison Shaw there. Well, that's the program for today. Thanks for joining us here on PM. I'm David Lipson. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For decades, we've turned to well-read textbooks to help us understand how our economy will behave. But right now, something strange is happening, and for some economists, it's a bit of a miracle. Today, business editor Ian Verrender on the current economic weirdness. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.